Great to have you with us for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are turning our attention to bulbs. Have you ever heard about a bulb lawn or maybe a partial bulb lawn? That's what we'll be talking about, at least in part, with our guest Mark Conlock. Mark is director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and he'll be talking about using spring bulbs in your garden. He'll also give us a sneak preview of this year's holiday display at the garden, and we'll talk about all kinds of things relating to the flower gardens and take your gardening questions. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mark Conlock, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Let's talk about bulb lawns to begin with. What is a bulb lawn?
Yeah, we have a couple of them here at the botanical garden where we've had, especially in no-mo grass mix, we have planted different things like grape hyacinth, a species tulip, a dwarf daffodil mixed together in there. And then what happens is, they will come up, actually somewhat different times. So it adds color throughout the early parts of the spring months. And then it's a way to use more space of your garden to get color because it's your lawn that you don't typically have, bulbs into. The one thing to know though is that after those bulbs do come up and flower, you do have to let the foliage, I call it dry down and die down, so that it will produce, a bulb with a flower for the next year. So that typically means you have to wait a little bit to mow your grass, like say 6-ish weeks after they bloom. So that's why we like to do it in the no-mow grass mix, because that's not grass that you typically mow that often. So that is like a good combination for anyone that has areas that they have switched over to that like less maintenance grass. And the other thing though is that you can do all those different things. Like there's a company called Color Blends that we use a lot as our source for our bulbs. And they have this part, if you go to their website, called Color Your Grass. And it's kind of a funny play on words, I guess. But they have like already made mixes of different combinations that you can just buy, that you can, throw on your grass and plant. And the other kind of cool thing about that is those bulbs are usually smaller miscellaneous bulbs, so you don't have to dig them as deep down, so it's a little less work for planting. Most bulbs only go 2 to 3 times deep as they are wide, so those bulbs all being little small guys, they barely need to get like knifed into the ground a little bit. So the other quick last thing I was going to share is, in our botanical garden last year, we had quite a bit of deer damage. So this year, what we're going to do is like use a lot more of different kinds of bulbs, including especially daffodils, but then use these color your grass mixes in our actual annual perennial planting beds to add to like the color and the inches throughout the whole season to, in essence, make up for tulips. They don't have the same amazing color palette as tulips do, but they will give us like color early, mid, and late to go in with our other bulbs, including the daffodils we've chosen. So last thing is a lot of those color your grass guys are critter proof for all of us out there that have issues with animals.
Well, I was thinking, you mentioned tulips. I would typically, was me, I might stay away from tulips and maybe hyacinths and go with the smaller.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree. Definitely the tulips, we love them though for all the different colors. But if you have, the deer problems, especially, it can be challenging to, keep them going. So we're going to shy away this year from it until we know that we don't have those animals eating. But like you said, tulips are definitely the one that animals, deer, rabbits like the most. So if you have those issues, you should, spend your money elsewhere, I would say. And there's a lot of other available bulbs that you can find.
Yeah. John wants to know, will the bulbs multiply?
Yes, definitely. Especially like our daffodil bulbs have multiplied over the years in our garden. So a couple interesting things about that is, if you have a, area with where they have multiplied, you can, if you don't have a huge amount of them, take the time, you know, later after they've flowered to dig them out, separate them, and spread them throughout your garden so that they can then get the nutrients they need to produce a flower the next year. Because sometimes in our areas, that has gotten to be the case where they'll have foliage now and no longer have a flower because they're so tightly packed that they can't mine the soil for enough nutrients. The other thing I heard from Brent of Brent and Becky's Bulbs way back in the day on the presentation he gave was he said he would, instead of doing all the work of transplanting them, fertilize that clump of bulbs after it was done flowering, or if it didn't flower in the times the other ones were done with, like, he just said he used 10-10-10 fertilizer to, you know, have enough fertility around where those roots are so that they have the energy to not only translocate the energy back to the bulb in the ground to make leaves, but they need the more, you know, energy to make the flower bud. So that's why they don't flower, is because there's not enough, you know, nutrients in the soil for them to find what they need to make that flower bud. So a couple of ideas are either divide them if that gets to be the case, or fertilize around them when they're doing the dry down part of the leaves so they have more energy and more nutrients to make that flower bud in the bulb.
So, you know, if you're putting them into a lawn, for example, what's the best way to dig the holes for those?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we did a couple of times is actually kind of an interesting thing. Like, we spray painted the bulbs with like neon marking paint that you can get at, you know, Menards, Home Depot, or the box stores or anywhere. And so that we could find them in the lawn in the first place, because we had like, you know, 30,000, we spray painted them. Now you can just like throw them and pitch them into the lawn. That's kind of the nice part of the design, is it's more of an informal look. And then what we would do is use our soil knives to like knife them into the ground. So yeah, the hard part is you have to dig 30,000 baby holes.
People with their lawns, are they wouldn't be doing 30,000 of them, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. And then you know, you could use a like an auger they sell, you know, but you don't usually need the hole to be that big for these little guys that are in the grass. Yeah. Or the other thing you could do actually is like take a spade or a shovel, and you can kind of like take up a clod of sod almost, and then throw a handful in there and then just like pat it back down in place. And that's a way to plant like a lot of bulbs fast in a little spot. It's just that they're all like jammed together, you know, so you might want to do that 5 or 7 different like clumps of that, you know, throughout your lawn space. But that's sometimes another way that we'll do it, or we'll do a combo of the sod pieces and then sprinkle in between so it's not so many knife holes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ellie in Middleton emailed to say they have a variety of irises and daffodils in their gardens. Can Ellie divide them in the fall, or is it a spring only activity?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. Usually, I mean, the daffodils, if she knows, you know, where they are and she like marked them in the springtime, say, I would say you could do that in the fall, because that's typically when you buy and plant those bulbs, you know, from a store. So that's no problem. And from what I know about irises, a lot of times, you know, people do buy those in the fall and divide them then. So like a lot of times you'll see people, you know, like that's when they do actually sell irises, is like root crops. So I always say go for it.
And fall planting is really kind of ideal for bulbs, is it not?
Yeah, the spring blooming bulbs are planted in the fall. So it is the time that you do that, yes.
So that makes the most sense. But, you know, we always get questions. I forgot to plant my bulbs in the fall. Can I store them over winter?
Well, I mean, what happens is the bulbs need a chilling period. You know, there's like a plant growth regulator called gibberellic acid that has to like get to certain levels for them to do stem elongation in the springtime, from what I remember about my horticulture degree at River Falls back in the day. And if they don't have that, you know, they're not successful. Also, what happens is when you plant your bulbs in the fall, we usually will water them into the, you know, water them in. And because what happens is it like hydrates the organelles of the bulb. And in the fall, the bulbs actually put their roots down. So if you don't have them in the soil, you know, it's kind of like too late to do it in the springtime. You know, what you could do is investigate. There's actually a new article in the American Gardener magazine about forcing bulbs. So like there's an interesting article there about how to force all kinds of different bulbs, but they're typically not the normal tulip and daffodil that we grow in our climate. There are other different things like amaryllis, paper white, some small miscellaneous iris reticulata, crocuses, and like some smaller things. So I would guess all I would say is if you didn't get a chance to plant them in the fall, you might just have to buy some in pots from somewhere in a local garden center and wait till next year.
Well, what we're trying to say here is get them in this. And how much time do we have?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of time still, Larry. Like it's a great time to go to those websites of different companies or go to a local, you know, garden center, or even big box stores and find bulbs that are, you know, for sale right now. Typically, we actually don't start planting our bulbs till around the first frost or the first, you know, weekish in October. A lot of that seems to have been, you know, changed and offset in the last, you know, couple of years where it's like nice, long, warm falls, at least in Northeast Wisconsin, where, you know, we kind of get to a stage where we have to plant it to get all the work done with the time we have, but it may not be exactly the right time to do it, you know? So we really don't start our planting in earnest till the beginning of October. So people have plenty of time to still, you know, buy stuff, look at their yard and decide, you know, like where they need some spring interest and, you know, purchase those bulbs. And we will hold on to them until we're ready to plant them. And what we do at the garden is we put them in this well house area. That's like a little bit of a cooler environment. It's like say 50-ish degrees to like hold them until we're ready to plant them. So I would suggest that you put it, you know, maybe in your basement or something until you're ready to actually plant those bulbs in the fall. And one final thought that is rattling around in this brain of mine is that despite, you know, like all the best times to do everything, all these bulbs that you planted in previous years, you know, are still in the ground in our environment that we have right now. And they're usually coming up successfully in the springtime. So, you know, you can obviously, I don't think you can go wrong if you planted them now because all the bulbs from previous years are in the ground living fine. You know, so sometimes you have to do it on the timeline that you have based on your busy life and availability and just hope for the best and know that probably it's going to work out because it does, just because that's how nature works.
Do you have some favorite bulb resources, places to get them?
Definitely. We get a lot of ours from this place called Color Blends, and they have, you know, their website is colorblends.com. And the reason is we got a bunch of them back when I first started, which was almost 20 years ago now. And, you know, they had some of the best sized bulbs for the most reasonable cost. And they're really easy to work with. They have a great website where you can, you know, order them immediately and get them really fast. We also do use Brent and Becky's bulbs, which has really unique specialty bulbs for the connoisseurs out there. People that are looking to get a little more something interesting or might have, you know, like a smaller space or want a specific color thing that Color Blends doesn't have in their palette of bulbs. And then there is a whole bunch of other different, you know, online sources that you can look at. And you can even just, you know, stop into a local garden center or even, like I said, the big box store and pick up some bulbs that catch your fancy. And oftentimes you can find some of the ones that are in those catalogs at those local places as well. So, you know, I say look for ones that interest you and like the daffodils and things. If you read up about them on those websites, you kind of can get really into it a lot, but there's certain ones like one called Tea Tea, that's like a little small one we like. And Tahiti, which is like a double flowered daffodil that, you know, I often see for sale, even in like a big box store, that are like really good cultivars that you can just find when you're perusing other merchandise.
Our guest today, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. We've been talking about bulbs for the most part, but we'll certainly take other flower and shrub-related questions as well as we visit with Mark, so I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Coming up on our show on Monday, we'll talk about lower back pain with our physical therapy experts, and then we'll take a look at dealing with an empty nest, which many people are probably going through in this fall season as school gets back to running. Right now, though, we're taking a look at plants, flowering plants, with Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. A couple of email questions for you, Mark. Jan in Viroqua called, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know what fertilizer should Jan be using on bulbs. Jan also wanted to share that they had good success with planting bulbs in flower pots and putting them in the refrigerator for 13 weeks before planting them outside.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, well, that's a good that good tip for those people that didn't plant their bulbs and might want to try to do the same thing that Jan did successfully. So that's a great idea. Interesting thing is, like, when you plant bulbs, you don't have to really add any fertilizer because the bulb has already has a flower formed inside of it. Kind of a really cool thing you can do yourself or with a kid in your family is if you dissect a tulip or daffodil bulb, you'll actually see like the small leaves and flower inside of there. And then the outside part of the bulb is like the food that will push it up and that'll, you know, cause it to grow. So we don't ever fertilize our bulbs at the botanical garden when we plant them, and we typically don't fertilize them ever afterward. The only reason we would do it is like the question you asked in the beginning, where if they, you know, get too tightly packed together and then they don't flower, then that would mean that they would require fertilizer. So a lot of times places will say, you know, different things you can put in like blood meal, bone meal or whatever, but we haven't ever done that for our bulbs. We did back a while ago use, you know, like Milorganite as an animal deterrent when we first planted, you know, to like to put that on the top. So the process we use that might be helpful for other, you know, people to know is that we'll plant the bulbs, we'll mulch that area typically, we'll give them a really good soak of water, and then we will spray that area with liquid fence or some other animal deterrent to like try to keep, you know, animals from going around there. And we also will like, you know, of course, like blow and clean up to try to get the, like the tunics and the part of the bulbs that fall off so that animals like squirrels and chipmunks and stuff don't use those as like a way to find the bulbs.
Makes good sense to me. Dale in Madison has a question for you. Dale, hello.
Hello. My neighbor next to me has a tree, which I believe is a staghorn sumac.
Okay.
And it has sent out roots into my yard, and currently I have about 5 to 6 plants growing. And I've looked at the root structure, and it's pretty woody right now. And I had thought about transplanting them to a different place in my yard, But are they going to be more invasive around another tree or pine tree?
Good question, Rob. Dale. I mean, Larry is already kind of smiling a little bit. Yeah, staghorn sumac, you know, is a suckering shrub that will take over, but that's not necessarily right a bad thing in the right location. And it is native to Wisconsin, has a nice fall color and everything. So a couple of things you could do is, you know, where those suckers or have you like put shoots out into your yard, you could like cut on either side of that root that it's coming from with a shovel. And what I would say is maybe what you want to do if you want to try to successfully transplant them is I would like, you know, do that now, cut that, but I would not maybe transplant it until next spring, because where you cut it, you'll have pruned it in essence, and it would maybe put out roots that would be more successful for the piece in the middle for you to be able to transplant in the springtime. You know, that would be one way to do it. If you don't want to, like in that area where he has his or she has hers, the neighbor coming into your yard, you know, you would have to like keep cutting those off or like, you know, cut the root on your property back to the property line, I guess. But it's always going to be a constant problem of that, you know, existing mother plant, if you will, coming into your yard. But I do like the fact that you're interested in propagating it and, you know, bringing it to the other parts of your yard. Of course, you could also, you know, buy a plant of staghorn sumac from a nursery and for sure successfully plant it in a different part of your yard. Yeah. Any thoughts on it at all, Larry?
I was just to clarify, with the shovel, the spade, you just dig down on one side of the plant and then just leave it until spring and then transplant it if you're going to do it that way.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that made sense to me. Dale, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ross in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I planted 8 hydrangea plants, kind of the ones that look like little trees. They're 6 foot tall. I bought them from a nursery. They look awesome when I planted them. But when I dug them down with a fence hole folder, I dug them down about 18, 16 inches. The pots were that I bought them from were 14 inches deep. So there's a little bit of loose soil on the bottom. But what I dug down into, the first couple inches was black soil, and then it got kind of a little rocky, and then it got to kind of clay. And I had a hard time digging them out. Someone said, just fill the holes full of water. So I filled the holes full of water overnight until it kind of loosened up the dirt that I could dig a little bit better. And then when I planted them, my brother-in-law filled the holes, just pumped full of water again. And within a week now, it's been about a week since I planted them, all the leaves are turning yellow like they're in shock. Or overwatered, I don't know whether to water them again or leave them alone, but the soil is kind of clayish. And so I'm kind of sitting here wondering, what should I do, water them or leave them alone?
So do you mean that like when you first dug into the soil, the top part was black soil and clay, and then you got to a layer of gravel and sand and more like open type material?
Yes, and then even a little bit deeper, the last 3-4 inches were kind of clay. Because after I watered them, it was just like digging through cement, but it made it easier to dig the hole out because it was so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, there's a lot to think about there, I'd say. But a couple just things in general. Okay, so when you have like a fine soil, this happens in containers and things too, you know, like where it's not recommended that in a container planting, people really put gravel or soda cans or whatever in the bottom, because what happens is the water stays in the small pore space of a finer soil or clay soil or like a garden soil, and then it doesn't drain into that open space of the bigger like sand particles. So, you know, in some ways you might have a case where that soil, if it's, you know, rocky, it has a lot of big pore spaces, and your water is staying in the like black soil part that's up higher and not draining out of it. So that could be one thing that's holding moisture up high. But the other thing would be, you know, so what you really want to do is like, you know, put your finger way down in there, or buy like, I just saw actually again in this American Gardener magazine, they had like a little fine soil probe that's like pretty inexpensive that you can like put into the ground to see what the moisture is. But a lot of times we just will, you know, dig in with our finger or a soil knife, you know, that you can get 6 inches deep and see how wet it is and if that moisture is being held up on the roots that, you know, where you said you might be too wet there. But in the other quick thing to tell you though, Ross, is like when you are planting, you do want to just plant into your existing soil, even if it's garbage, and plant plants that like that soil versus like amending it and doing, you know, putting a lot of black dirt, if you will, because then the roots will just stay in that nicer soil, and never mind the outside parts of your soil profile for water and nutrients, and then they'll be more susceptible to drought. So, you know, I think you did the right thing by planting in the soil that you have. You can, as a soil amendment on the outside ring, I usually like to put it at the drip line and beyond, you know, like put an inch of compost that then can percolate down and kind of like add to the soil that might not be the best around there, and definitely like put 2 to 3 inches of organic mulch around the outside of that. You know, like you don't want it up against the trunk, but you want it, you know, maybe 3 inches away from those standard hydrangeas and then outward to the drip line and beyond to like help hold moisture so that, you know, you water it once a week, a good deep thorough watering, and then it, you let it dry out in between waterings. So I don't think you should water it until you check to see how moist your soil is. And, you know, it may be a bit of like, I hope it's not too far gone already, but I would definitely let it dry out first, check it, and then water it thoroughly, you know, like once a week, let it dry between waters and check it. And make sure the other quick thing is, because, you know, it's been warm and dry in our Septembers and Octobers for everybody, for all of our plants, all of us should make sure that we water, you know, in September and even October now, so that our new trees, shrubs, and perennials go into winter stronger, so they're more likely to make it through the winter, whatever kind of winter we have, whether it's snowy or not. So that's maybe not the best answer, but that's what I would say, is I would just check for water and not water it if it's moist to let it dry out because of how much you guys watered it in the first place. What do you think, Larry?
I think that's a pretty good answer, Mark. Thank you very much, Ross, for calling. Appreciate it. Ann in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Okay, about amaryllis plants. I have several amaryllis that bloomed nicely last winter. The leaves have continued to grow. I put them outside in the shade, and the leaves kept growing and growing. Now I put the pots back inside, and my question is, will they rebloom if the leaves keep growing, or do they need to die off?
That is a great question, too. What I have done is a very similar thing to what you have done, where I've grown them outside all summer long, and then what you do, just like you did, is you bring it inside, but then you stop watering it, and you do want to let the leaves you know, dry off and dry down and die off. And then you need to put it in a dark environment for like 12 to 14 weeks. You can look it up, but that's about what it usually says to do. So I actually put it like in a closet where I have all my work clothes. I mean, so it does get like lit up when I walk in there, but I'll put it in there, and I'll also write down on my calendar, you know, when I need to take it out of that dark period. So it needs that like dry, dark storage. You can just put the whole pot or container into that area if you have enough space. That's what I typically do in my like walk-in closet thing I have. Or you can, you know, take the bulb out of there and just have the bulb be in that dark environment. And then after that time period, you would take it out and start, you know, giving it some water, plant it back in soil if you took it out of soil, and then it will rebloom. It's just that it won't typically bloom the time like when you bought it, it blooms. So I've done that many years, and I've even like collected seed, and we've grown them at the botanical garden, and we have like a double red one that we've collected seed from amaryllis for. So it's actually possible to do. It just can be a bit time consuming. And sometimes people will say, hey, I'll just buy a new bulb and then I don't have to do any of that work. But you do kind of get attached to them. So I would definitely go for it. And so bring it in, let it dry down and die down, put it into a dark environment, dry for 12 to 14 weeks or whatever you find that when you Google it, and then take it out, give it a little water, and it'll bloom, you know, maybe around a different time of the year, like Easter or something like that.
All right. And there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Ellen in Eau Claire had called, couldn't stay with us. Ellen wants to know if there are bulbs that are deer resistant and do better in shade.
Okay, well, that's a, yeah, there's a couple of them that we've used here. There's one, I can never pronounce the Latin name the best, but it's like Leucosimum or something like that. They call it like, I think it's winter snowflake or giant snowflake or giant snowdrop. But that one is a good one for shade. Its leaves look like a daffodil, but it kind of looks like a giant snowdrop. So that one, again, is one you can get from Color Blends. And then the like Spanish bluebells are another one that can grow in some part shade, and they bloom a little bit later in the late spring, early summer, but they have a beautiful blue flower and they can take some part shade pretty well too. So those two are great ones for part shade environments.
Let's turn to an email from Mark in Madison. Several years ago in the fall, they planted a bunch of bulbs using both an auger to get a deeper hole and a hand trowel for faster but shallower stabs and drop planting. The next morning, all the auger hole plantings had been dug up, presumably by squirrels, but the stab and plant bulbs were unbothered. Mark was not happy about losing the day's augering effort, but also puzzled about the reason for the stark dichotomy. Was it perhaps easier for the bushy-tailed tree rats to locate the bulbs by smell or dig through the soil loosened by the auger?
Those sound like pretty good ideas to me, you know, that it would be the looser soil of the auger, right? And it's really noticeable where that auger was. Like I mentioned, how we'll kind of cover up those areas and put liquid fence on there is a way, you know, to keep that from happening. But I would guess that those are pretty good thoughts by Mark on why they dug it up in the auger holes, because they were easier to dig in and really noticeable holes. So yeah. In the future, I would say, you know, definitely could hand trowel them all, or you could try to, you know, put some mulch and spray the soil surface with some kind of smelly thing that repels animals. And like I said, the other thing is if you're planting a bunch and you knock those outside covering tunics off, it's good to like kind of blow those away or get those out of the way so there's no clue for these Sherlock Holmes squirrels to find the place to go.
Jim in Abbotsford, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is, I planted some gladiolas in a raised bed garden, and when they started to flower, they dry up right away. The first flower, second flower, and then they just dry up and never bloom anymore. I don't know if I did something wrong or not.
Boy, I don't know for sure either, Jim. As long as you know, like planted them, kept them watered good. I don't know, you know, like what kind of gladiolus, you know, issue that could be, honestly. The only thing I could say would be to, you know, make sure they were well watered, that they might dry out in a raised bed pretty, you know, easily. But sounds like you kind of had done everything right. I don't know if there is a disease of a gladiola like that, unfortunately, but.
Yeah, I don't know either. We're a little stumped on that one, Jim. It could have been a water question issue. But beyond that, I'm not sure either. Maybe somebody else has an idea, can call in with a suggestion. 800-642-1234. Let's go to Connie in Green Bay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I first have to give a quick shout out and thank Mark for all the work he did when he helped us with the pollinator habitat at NWTC. Thanks, Mark. and then I have a question. The blue stem grass that we have growing in our pollinator habitat is growing beautifully. We have a few patches of them, and we want to transplant one. Would it be best to do it now in the fall or wait till spring to move that?
Okay. What I like to say to everybody about those kinds of questions is do it whenever you want to. As long as you get like a good, like the entire root system, which can be, you know, hard and make it, you know, a bigger, heavier plant to move, you know, like with those, I would say you could do it now and then, you know, make sure you may have to make sure that you water it in to successfully transplant it again into that September, October time period is probably, you know, safest to do it in the spring or early summer. But, you know, little bluestem being a warm season grass doesn't oftentimes start growing like immediately right away. It takes it a little bit to like grow and come out of the ground. So you might want to wait till the spring, but then, you know, you have to wait till you can kind of like see the clump and what's alive of it actually. So I think you can do that anytime, but, you know, you're safer in spring. But if you want to do it because you want to get it done and you want to like, you know, move on from that area and try it, I would say that you could still do it now, even though it means you have to get a good part of the root system and you need to make sure that you don't just transplant it and forget about it, that you give it that inch of water to get it established and to make sure it goes into the winter strong.
Makes sense. Connie, good luck. Thank you. Jane in Marinette, on to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I've got a single peony plant that I've had for quite a while, and every year I keep thinking it's going to blossom more than one bud. And so I was going to transplant it this fall, which I heard is the best time, and I want to make, should I put other peony plants with it and then transplant it so that where there is full sun?
All right. Peonies in full sun?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to put it in full sun, and when you transplant it, you know, you want to make sure that you don't plant it too deep. I believe you only want, like, the eyes of it to be about an inch or so deep because, you know, peonies that are planted deep can, like, be quote-unquote blind where they won't flower. So that, I mean, maybe that's even a reason why it only has one flower right now. So when you do dig it up, take a look at where, you know, those growing points are and make sure on your transplant that you only have those like an inch or so below the soil surface so that you do, more likely you'll get more flowers just by that transplanting of it like that. And definitely full sun, more sun, the more energy, the more flowers you'll get.
Jane, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark, we sent you an email about an azalea plant, so you can be looking at that while I remind everybody that Mark Conlock is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Join with your questions. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Talking plants today and flowering plants with Mark Conlock of the Green Bay Botanical Garden. We will go right back to the phones. Lyle in Montello, it's your turn now. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, guys. You guys were talking about the bulb yards earlier.
Yeah.
And ways to do that. I was wondering what you thought about maybe using like a yard aerator to punch the holes in and then come through and plug the holes in or the bulbs into those.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, that sounds like an interesting idea. I guess the only quick thing that came off the top of my head would be your bulbs would be like kind of on a grid pattern. That way, you know, where you might want to actually go over it a couple times in different directions or, you know, kind of like, you know, do it so that you don't have holes that are just when you plant it, it'll look like, you know, a giant checkerboard.
Yeah, that makes sense. Or you could throw them out there, like you said, Mark, earlier, note the paint them or something so you can tell where they are. And then just do your own kind of sprinkling them around right where they fell.
Yeah, or put them, you know, not put them in every single hole that you punch with the aerator, you know, throw them out there and then put them to the closest hole and fill everything with soil and just some might not have a bulb in them.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Lyle, that'll work. Thanks for calling. Whitney in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Whitney.
Hi, Larry. I'm a big fan. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've got a question about, we've gotten really into pollinator-friendly gardens at our house lately, and we are hooked. So we've had beds, but we want to replace the entire boulevard in front of our house with a pollinator garden next spring. But we don't really want to fight with the grass. Should we go ahead and try to kill our grass this year, or should we wait until next spring?
I would say to go ahead and kill your grass this year. There, you know, we've done a couple of these pollinator corridor habitats with the city of Green Bay, where we're trying to build this corridor between the east and west side of the city, and we're doing, you know, a pretty good job. And when they do the Green Bay Conservation Corps does a lot of the work ahead of us. We grow the plants and help them plant them and do the design. But this year it was really great because they did all of the turf removal the previous fall, and then they prepared the area by, you know, putting mulch on it, so that it was all ready to go and you don't have to worry about how much it rains in the springtime. It doesn't slow you up from, you know, what other weather implications there might be. And it kind of like lets everything just like be ready to do the job as soon as you have the plants in the, you know, spring, summer of next year. So a couple ways you can do it, of course, like what they do at the Conservation Corps is just literally remove all the sod with a sod cutter and by hand and then mulch it. You could, of course, if you're, you know, willing or interested, use an herbicide to do that still with the warm temperatures, you know, that we're going to have. That would be effective. You could do the solarization with, you know, black plastic, but that, of course, takes time. So you probably wouldn't have time to do that this year still. So you're probably, I guess I'd say as I'm talking here, that your options are herbicide or stripping off that sod. And then I would go ahead and put, you know, the 2 to 3 inches of an organic mulch on there and then be all ready to plant it the next year.
Yeah, there you go. I'll have that myself next year because we had street repairs. And so my native area, which ran between the sidewalk and the street, is long gone. And I'm going to have to do it all again, all over again next spring. Whitney, there you go. Thanks for calling. Dave in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Well, I have a Weigelia plant, or I don't know, maybe it's Weigelia plant. I'm not sure how people pronounce it, but it's got green flower or green leaves, and it climbs, and it's got red flowers. And I believe it only is supposed to last for one season, but wondering if I could bring it in and have it over winter and then take it back out in the spring if it would still come back.
Oh, I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly what you have. You know, a Weigelia is definitely a plant that grows in Wisconsin, but it's a shrub, you know, that it does, you know, it's hardy to our area. So it's going to come back year after year and bloom in the summer. Do you know if it's something else that you have?
That's what the tag said. So I bought it at a floral place in the spring of the year that doesn't really sell a lot of shrubs and things. It's more flowers. So
okay, well, but Dave, feel free to, you know, take a picture of that tag and email me it to, you know, my email at the garden, mconlock@gbbg.org, and I can take a look at it and see if it's that or something different, and then I'll get back to you on, you know, what to do. If it is a vine, you know, some of them you can overwinter, but sometimes it's, you know, easier just to pitch it and buy a new one in the springtime because it's just like not worth the effort to overwinter it if it's a tropical vine.
Yeah, for sure. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You could still join in at 800-642-1234. Mark, we've got a couple of photos too that we got. The one is about an azalea, and I don't know if you have that up.
Yeah, I saw it. It's like, you know, pretty chlorotic and speckled.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not totally sure what that is, honestly. So that's another one kind of similar to Dave's where I'll have to do some further investigation and then I can get back to the email about that. I did look at, there was another one we had that you're probably going to mention of the cottonwood tree, and not exactly sure what the speckling on that is, but I would say for that, you know, there are a lot of cosmetic just leaf diseases, and I wouldn't be too overly concerned about that if it is just, you know, the leaf discoloration, because, you know, later in the season we've had the different conditions, you know, for different diseases to be there. Those pathogens are out there, and when it's just the leaves, you know, they fall off anyway, and unless it's something on, you know, the woody tissue, you really don't have to be worried about those like cosmetic leaf diseases on a lot of trees and things. At least that's what I learned in my short time at the extension.
We had an email relating to an earlier email from Mark who had his bulb plants, the ones that he did with an auger, all dug up the next day by the squirrels. And Vicki in Eau Claire called with a suggestion. She suggests protecting the bulbs from being dug up by using some kind of chicken wire or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you have, you know, like a small area or say, you know, a garden bed that you incorporate bulbs amongst other things that, you know, it's small enough to be able to like cover it with hardware cloth or chicken wire or something like that. Other times people will like, you know, say they planted a container of bulbs or something, they might put like, you know, angular rocks or, you know, gravel in there to like make it less likely that animals will want to like dig through that material. So those are a couple of different options, especially like the hardware cloth or chicken wire, like she mentioned.
I don't want time to get away before we talk about some of the events, Mark. And I know your holiday light show at the Green Bay Botanical Garden is always spectacular. Tell us what people are going to see this year.
Yeah, definitely. That's a very exciting time. We have about, you know, 350,000 lights and 40 different nature-inspired displays out there. We're actually going to be setting that up pretty soon. You know, that usually takes us quite a while to set all those lights up and get everything going so that it's ready for the Friday after Thanksgiving is when it opens and it goes through after Christmas. So we have all of our awesome displays that we've had in the past, but a couple of the new ones that I've seen or got a little sneak peek of are one that's called Tic Tac Snow, where it's an interactive giant tic-tac-toe board that you get to like do with your friends or family. So that sounds pretty cool, and I like the play on words of it. And the other bigger one is a laser with fog machine. So I saw like a little setup video of it where it has, you know, it's still in the works of being programmed, but it has like a laser dragonflies flying around on our stage and going through the smoke and different, you know, patterns throughout the air, swirling around in our Grand Garden amphitheater area. So that looks really exciting and different and a new technology, you know, to add to the light show to go amongst all of the things that we already have out there. So I'm excited to see that in motion.
And when does it start again?
It starts November 28th. So the Friday after Thanksgiving is the first kickoff day, and then it goes till after Christmas. So all of that stuff is on our website, which is gbbg.org. And there'll be all the special information about the light show on there soon. If it's not there right now, I believe, but it'll be up there soon. And quick other thing is we have new this year, an app. So there'll be information about that light show on the app. So if you go to, you know, the App Store or the Google Play Store, it's just Green Bay Botanical Garden you search for, and then you can get information about everything happening on that app. And it also lets you know where you are in the garden so you won't get lost as you're navigating through all these amazing things.
It's great. Yeah, you got a lot to see there. I've always enjoyed visiting the garden, and it's a big area.
Yeah. It really is. And, you know, the other thing, there's right now, everything is really looking great in the garden. So if you know, if you're coming up for a Packer game or going up to Door County to see the lights, you know, swing on by and say hi to us, because all of our annuals are still in bloom in their full glory. And then all of the perennials, trees and shrubs that we have, which is over 100,000 permanent plants in our collection now, which has grown quite a bit. So there's a lot of great things to see in the fall. And because it, you know, has been so nice and mild and we've been watering all those things, they're looking amazing still. And we haven't had frost and don't anticipate that for a little bit up here. So come on by and say hi to all the plants at Green Bay Botanical Garden. And, you know, check out our website for information about other events and things that might interest you.
I love the garden. And how many years has the garden been in existence?
Whatever 2025 minus 1996 is.
Well, it'd be 29 years if you ask me.
Yeah, so 29 years, yeah.
29 years. And I remember being a speaker at one of the fundraisers, one of your big fundraisers before it opened, and I've had that association all those years, and it's certainly been well worth it, and quite an addition to the Green Bay area, and not only Green Bay, but people come from all over to see it. So thank you for your work.
You bet, and thanks for being part of it, Larry. We really consider ourselves, you know, a community garden, kind of like in a different way than vegetables, where I know it's been a lot of people in our community that have built this garden and take care of it and love it and support it in all different ways. So we just love sharing it with everyone that comes to this area and love sharing it with our community.
Next time I'm up there, I'll have to chat with you about that original talk I gave sometime. Mark, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Larry.
Mark Conlock, Director of the Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. He'll be back, and we'll do it again with him. Oh, man. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about your lawns, so look forward to that. And thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to our team for producing our shows every day, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Have a great time and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.